This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Muck. Today I'm speaking to Dr. Siva Kumari, Director General of the International Baccalaureate Organization, or the IBO. Thank you for coming on the show with us, Siva.
Thank you.
So, Siva, IB has expanded to become a globally recognized course. And while your business is currently, predominantly in North America, Asia is typically seen as a growing force in education, what with a growing demographic, a rising middle class, particularly in China. So are you seeing a corresponding growth in this region of the world?
Yes, we are seeing growth in Asia, as you said, for all of the reasons you cited. And we're also seeing growth in Europe and Latin America. So I think it's a pretty diversified growth portfolio that we have. But yes, we are seeing growth in China and Japan and Korea, and of course in Malaysia as well, which I'm sure we'll speak about.
Yes, so perhaps you could take us through what kind of expansion plans IBO has. Where are you targeting for growth?
So our model does not work that way. We don't actually aggressively go after any market. What we do is we have most of our growth comes from word of mouth. So schools will tell other schools, or schools in the area will see the benefit of having IB in a country. And then, more schools request contacts with us. The other type of growth we are seeing increasingly in our world is where people are studying the IB, whether they're groups of schools or in some cases ministries of education, and they're inviting the IB to be a part of the landscape of educational offers that they're giving their young people. So I think that's the way we grow. So it's a more we are reliant on organic growth as opposed to targeting places.
There have been quite a few changes in terms of educational policy in China, particularly in regards to what they call Western-centric private schools. So how do you balance those kinds of educational policy changes versus maintaining your standard of IB?
The standards question in and of itself is a very interesting one, so I'll address that. What we do is we have a set of international standards that we derive from either for the subjects or for our philosophy of education. And the philosophy of education is, as you probably know, education for life and education for a better world. So those standards are quite classic, I think. Again, because schools and choose us, they spend a lot of time thinking about, how do they adapt to the country's policies versus the IB's policies. And in most cases, those are not contradictory. So in a sense, we are not big enough in any country to go, to go against any of the country standards. So we tend to coexist, if you will.
So there has been some research to suggest that, IB students in the US and as well as in the UK, they do better upon entry into university programs. But that same study doesn't necessarily show a marked improvement in Asia as well as Australia. So what's your take on that? Is IB perhaps unsuited to our Asian culture of study?
I hope not. I think it's a question of what better means, right? So IB students going through the program are going through quite a rigorous program that demands quite a lot from them and quite a lot from the teacher. And the way I tend to think about it is that we are preparing them with a very broad set of skills that applies to not just university, if that is their destination, but actually, lifelong learning. I mean, the kind of skills we teach, the kind of critical thinking we are hoping to develop, the kind of broad scale application of knowledge across disciplines, et cetera, is a hard thing to do. So I think if students are doing well in getting into universities, that's one thing. But, you know, our studies also show, and, you know, anecdotally, our IB alumni also tell us that, you know, once they land in the university, the comparison between the preparation between IB and any other program is simply quite different.
And as you said, it is a very rigorous course, but and you do prepare students for a broad range of further education. But at what cost? I mean, mental health complaints are fairly common amongst IB students. What's the incidence of mental health issues arising from the International Baccalaureate?
I'm not sure we are measuring the mental health issues just among IB students. We are doing a study about what is the workload effect on students generally.
Yeah, so you are looking into mental health issues in regards to your students?
I think the whole world of education is looking into that, not just of IB students, but students in general. In fact, you know, just adults in general. And I think that's a good idea to be paying attention to what's happening to us, because we're living in a completely different world now. Information is not coming to us from local sources, it's not coming to us from storytellers from a particular area, country. You know, we are getting storytelling from all over the world, and we have to deal with that information. Students are having to deal with Instagram constantly and all other forms of social media that they used to. So the human brain is going to, is obviously going through some challenges with the new world that we live in. So I think this is a common problem everywhere.
Mm. But specifically for the International Baccalaureate programs, do you track mental health issues amongst your students? And perhaps you could give us some insight into what kinds of measures you are looking to implement, perhaps, to address them.
So, IB is not easy, but there are many other programs that are not easy, you know, and the pressures at that age. I mean, I guess you're speaking particularly to our DP program, which is the mm-hmm. pre-university program. The pressures at that age are many. So I think specifically what we are thinking about is, you know, what is the world telling us? What is the world of research telling us about mental health issues? And when we say mental health, you know, it's a broad range of areas, of course. We are trying to think through, you know, how much are we assessing? Because assessment usually is the area where the stress comes. What are we assessing, and why do we need to assess that? So we're spending a lot of time thinking about that. Mm. IB is one piece of other competing agendas that the child has at that age. So I think it's also important to keep that in mind. So yeah, we are constantly thinking about what are our programs doing, what is the impact on children, what is the impact on teachers. And we, at the end of every exam, we ask the teachers, was this exam hard? Was it easy? Was it just about right? And we tend to use those as measures of how we are doing. And that's data we use to calibrate our courses and the kind of results we give out and all of that. But it is an international program, and therefore it is going to cause some stress, you know, hopefully not too much stress to break the child, but enough to kind of prepare them for life after.
So, Siva, what would you say then to the wide perception that IB is an elitist program geared towards almost favouring gifted students to the detriment of those who are perhaps not so much in the gifted bracket?
You know, it's that perception of elitism, as far as saying that this program is for gifted students, is a sad perception. Definitely, the students who achieve the highest score have prioritized academics and do spend a lot of time, you know, studying and preparing and all of that. But I'm not quite sure that that's the only reason to do the IB. I think, you know, there are students who attempt the IB, and if you don't focus on the score, you get a lot from the program. You know, you get organizational skills, you get ability to think broadly, and that thinking broadly and thinking critically is a really, really, really important skill for us in this day and age. And that applies to any level student. Any level student can be trained to think more broadly, to represent their thoughts better, to achieve certain standards, etc. And we have research to show, certainly we have research from a study we've conducted, not we, but somebody externally conducted, on underprivileged children studying the IB showed that even if they were not hitting the scores, they're not getting 7 is our highest score. So even if they're not getting 7, they have achieved a lot of benefit. So, you know, I mean, it's a sad perception. I get asked about it all the time. There's a different kind of perception that we're only for the schools where there are rich resources. We are refuting them through evidence all the time. Through evidence as in, you know, our scores show there's like lots of students attempting it. It's open access in many schools, so you don't have to come through the gifted, you don't have to have a particular score to get into the IB program. So we have evidence, but it is a perception, and we'll try to continue to refute it.
And we're going to be continuing our conversation about the IB programs in just a little while. I'm speaking with Dr. Siva Kumari, a Director General of the International Baccalaureate Organization, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking to Dr. Siva Kumari, a Director General of the International Baccalaureate Organization. Thank you for joining us, Siva. Now, earlier we were talking a little bit about IB and your expansion plans, as well as some of the perceptions of elitism. But now I'd just like to ask, is there room here for IB schools perhaps with lower fees? Because I understand that cost can sometimes be a barrier. Here in Malaysia, it could cost a school something like 200,000 ringgit over the course of 5 years in order to get teachers certified. And an IB school also has to pay yearly fees. So is there room here for IB schools to be charging lower fees to its students?
So the fees that the schools charge has nothing to do with that. So we have I don't have the conversion rate between the dollar and the Malaysian ringgit, but we have a $10,000 annual fee for the programs. And yes, the professional development fees, I'll talk about that in a minute. There are schools, all around the world which charge a high amount of fees. Even in the same geography, actually, even in the same, 5 to 10 mile radius, you'll have a school that charges really a high amount, and you'll have a school supported by public, so there's actually no fee. So we are not responsible for the fees that the schools set. We July, we announced the removal of $172 registration fee. And for our our professional development, we are continuing to think of ways in which to give away more and more knowledge in this new world where, the means of distributing knowledge has become cheaper. We are thinking of more and more ways in which we can give away our PD for less and less money on a regular basis. On our website, we've announced, free PD for nano PD for our latest releases in our primary year program, our online courses we are creating on demand. We've reduced the fees for the PD we are going to be charging, inside the school itself, etc. And I have made it a point of pride for my tenure as Director General to ensure that we're not raising our fees and that we're running a very very well-run organization, so that we're not having to increase our fees.
And actually, IBO is a non-profit organization. So what are you actually doing with your surplus funds? Because your financial position is quite healthy. You've seen significant revenue growth over the past couple of years. So what are you planning to be doing with the money that you generate?
So a couple of things. Yes, we are a Swiss-based not-for-profit. The top line revenue increase has remained about the same. It's a 5 to 6% increase, which is, you know, it's not outstanding, but it's good. What we have done is actually cut a lot of our costs. We've been on that process for the past 5 years. We've looked at ourselves and said, do we need all this space? And we, you know, cut out an entire floor in one of our offices. We are constantly looking at our travel. So we've done a whole lot of things. Our bank charges, who we are hiring to do our audits. So that's really how we've kind of built up what you're calling the surplus. And the reason that is important for an organization like the IB is that it gets funding from nowhere else. So I think it's very, very important for it to maintain its intellectual independence so that it doesn't have to worry about growth all the time. You know, you make compromises when you're focused on, do I have enough money to run the organization? Then you're making compromises all the time. So I tend to think of it as we run ourselves well. In my view, we could be increasing our research and giving schools more research so they can implement research-based pedagogy with their teachers, etc. So the way we tend to think of it is increase the amount that of educational benefit that the schools are getting from us and try to keep the fees for the schools the same.
And Siva, just to close with a question about IBO as an organization itself, you were appointed Director General in 2014, and there have been some complaints that company culture has within IBO has eroded since then. I mean, I took a look at some reviews on Glassdoor, and IBO has a 2.6 out of 5 approval rating, and only 26% out of the 100 or so reviews checked approve of CEO, as in yourself. So how do you respond to these allegations of micromanagement and even toxic leadership within the IBO?
That is the saddest part for me. I've spent a lot of time in my career before coming to the IB and have come to the IB and have led the organization in a manner that I think is respectable and earns the respect of my colleagues. So it is sad that that particular platform allows for anonymous reviews without anything. Anyone can post, any disgruntled employee can post on there, and you don't have to be an employee currently. There's no gatekeeping to that. So I am aware of it, but I'm, you know, the what I tend to focus in on is not an anonymous platform that allows for that kind of postings to happen. I'm not focusing on it enough to ask my HR team to encourage our employees to post and all of that, because, you know, companies can counter that. And certainly many of my leaders tell me there's a way to counter that. There's a way to have a strategy to encourage all of your known and willing employees to go and post to counter those things. I really don't believe in it. I don't think that's the way we should be spending our time. I think my results speak for itself. And if you go to other companies, you can see the same thing. You know, you go to other educational companies, which I won't name because I don't want to give that platform any more weight than it deserves. You see the same things. I think, you know, culture is a hard thing. We run an organization that's running in 5 different parts of the world. We brought a lot of change along, and the results continue to show. They speak for themselves, I think.
I understand from one of these such complaints that IBO has abolished the position of ombudsman. Is that true?
Yes.
So what was the rationale behind that? Because an ombudsman is almost like a public advocate, right? So one would assume that it would bridge the gap between employees and board members in order to get any perhaps employee complaints across.
Well, I mean, that's one form of way to get, a healthy culture. But there's other formats. And I think the process we've taken is that we have a healthy organizational culture where employees feel they can talk to their manager and their manager feels they can talk to someone else, etc. I think problems are best solved at that level. I think if you have a culture where you have a place where, you know, it's all going to one person, or people feel, you know, that there's a source where you can go and talk and not solve your problems, that's not quite healthy. And we're also working on our HR being a safe space. And we know that many of our employees are using those forums. So yes, Ombudsman is one space to have. But, you know, we made a choice that the way we are proceeding is to ensure that we have a very healthy culture in the organization, so that anonymous formats are not the ways to kind of hold our problems and show them that we really want to be able to talk to each other.
Thank you very much for speaking to us, Siva.
Oh, thank you.
I've been speaking to Dr. Siva Kumari, Director General of the International Baccalaureate Organization, or the IBO. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.